Welcome to the Hump Day Podcast. My name is Pastor Kevin Robertson. It is March 15th of 2017. Now, I have the privilege of introducing Laura Alavisi. Did I pronounce that right?
Pretty good.
Okay, I'm all proud of myself because it took me a long time, Alavisi. And so, first of all, Laura, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you.
And let me be the first one to tell you, whoever's listening, we did a podcast last week. And we finished it up. And then Laura started breaking off, talking about all this stuff that I'm going, why didn't we talk about this in the podcast? So I asked her, do you mind if you come back, Laura, and let's talk about some of these issues? Because I was so impressed about Laura, where she's come from, her views of life, her perspective about interracial relationships. And so anyway, Laura, your last name. The one I can't pronounce.
Sure. Olabisi.
Olabisi.
Yes.
Yeah, I butchered it. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So it means wealth or honor multiplies in my husband's native language, which is Yoruba from West Africa.
Okay. So your husband is from West Africa.
He is. He's from Nigeria.
Okay, cool. And so how long you guys... Well, first of all, when did you guys first meet?
We met in 2003.
Okay.
In the fall. Yep.
And where did you meet?
We met in upstate New York. At the time, I was a PhD student at the State University of New York in Syracuse, and he was a master student at Cornell University.
Okay. So you both are very highly educated.
For better or worse, yeah.
For better or for worse.
Yeah.
And so you're a professor.
Yes.
At Michigan.
Michigan State University.
Michigan State University. Mm-hmm. And what do you focus on as a new professor?
So I'm an ecologist. I study relationships between people and the environment, and I mostly focus on agriculture and climate change and food security in Africa and in the U.S.
So you're an environmentalist, which is why I like you.
Sure.
And I'm sure this current administration is driving you crazy.
Well, it's certainly, you know, as somebody who works on climate change issues and with climate science, it's certainly not what I had hoped for, but I see a lot of hope in what's happening at regional and state levels and local levels in the United States, particularly here in California.
Okay.
So that's what I'm focusing on right now.
Oh, that's perfect. And Oregon and some states like Washington, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's 30-some states, or I don't know, but there's a lot of states that are really concerned about the environment.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm pretty good. So tell me when you accepted Christ in your life.
Yeah. So I was raised Presbyterian. My mother took us to church and to Sunday school when we were little. And when I was 13, I went through the youth group confirmation class at my church, which was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I think that was the first time that we really read large chunks of the Bible, particularly the Gospels and the teachings and example of Jesus.
Okay.
And I was just blown away by the person of Jesus and just, you know, really, fell in love with him, as people say. And that was when I started to own my faith as my own, as opposed to this is just something I go to church with my mom. It really became my own at that point.
Okay. So then you grew up and you graduated from high school. When did you graduate?
1995 from high school.
Okay.
And then I went to college. And so in college, I was looking for a fellowship to connect with because I really wanted to deepen my faith. And I felt like I'd been kind of struggling with it alone throughout the high school years. So I remember walking onto the campus of Brown University where I went and just looking at the bulletin board and seeing, okay, is there a group that studies the Bible? Yes, there is. Okay, I'll just go there.
Okay.
Not knowing anything about, you know, the theology of different fellowship groups or you know, how they study the Bible. But so that's how I ended up being a part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship for 4 years.
Okay.
At Brown.
Well, InterVarsity, and that's a good organization.
It is, and there's a lot of good things that I learned from them.
Mm.
There was a lot of good in the chapter at that time at Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider myself an evangelical at this point, and
why is that?
Well, it was never a good fit, to be honest. There are things I very much appreciate about evangelicals. I love that they take the Bible seriously, and they all read it a lot on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that emphasis on reading the Bible and Bible study was exactly how I got to understand the Bible for myself and can actually kind of counter some narratives that I don't agree with. So I respect that. I respect the fact that there was a lot of emphasis on living out your faith in your daily life, at least in many aspects, and on building friendships and building community with other Christians, which I thought was lovely. But I guess I just, you know, the fundamental kind of stumbling block for me is that I just don't, the core of evangelicalism, I think that people would agree on is that, you know, Christianity is the only quote right religion. It's the only, you know, Christians go to heaven and everybody else goes to hell. And I just, I can't quite get on board with that. And there are a number of other kind of secondary teachings that I'm not quite on board with either.
So going through the college and stuff, you accepted Christ under the evangelical movement and the different ministries. But then you moved to the Philippines, and I think that's where things started changing, didn't it, with you?
Absolutely.
Your perspective on Christianity?
To be honest, you know, by the time I graduated college, I was not so...
I want you to lie. Just lie.
No, that's fine. I mean, by the time I graduated, you know, I was losing my keenness on the American church for a number of reasons.
Okay.
And the Philippines is what really revived my faith, and I think is the reason why I'm a Christian today, because it gave me like a totally different view of Christianity. Because what I found in the Philippines, and so I was working there through a program of the Presbyterian Church USA called the Young Adult Volunteers, but they placed me with an organization in the Philippines that worked with the United Church of Christ in the Philippines. So that was their partner church.
Okay.
And the United Church of Christ in the Philippines is a very... very community-oriented, social justice-focused church.
Okay.
And I learned in the Philippines about, we were talking about earlier, liberation theology, or the Philippine version of it, which is basically the notion that God is on the side of the poor. God champions the poor, the marginalized, and the oppressed.
Right.
And so if you want to find God, that's where you have to go. That's where God
poor.
Is. Yeah.
Okay. And then, and the thing is, you didn't get that in the evangelical movement when you were in college. You didn't. You were struggling with scripture and then the reality of lifestyle, the evangelical lifestyle.
I mean, to be honest, I don't see that in the American church, period, with very few exceptions. Mainline, evangelical, whatever. I do not see you
what?
Know, liberation theology influence there at all. I don't see the church in America aligning itself with the poor and marginalized, regardless of denomination.
Right, right. So when you went to the Philippines, you said... And then you became aware of the liberation theology. Is that and then you said, this is consistent with the gospel.
That's what it rang true to me, and it rang true to me because I was in that situation. I was living with people on a garbage dump in Metro Manila. I was walking with people through a valley that had been just decimated with mining waste that had spilled over and like, you know, ruined everybody's crops and the you know, the valley looked like a moonscape.
Okay.
I mean, I was living in that situation and seeing people who were struggling for their basic lives and rights. And this theology rang true to me because it felt like, you know, if God is not on these people's side, then what use is God?
Right.
Like he can't be anywhere.
Right.
But I felt God in a very powerful way in those situations.
You know, it's interesting. There was a professor at APU years ago that he did a speaking, and his title of his talk was "Why God Hates Black Children." And basically, he was using the American theology, and if that's true, the American theology and evangelicalism, then God hates black people.
Yeah.
Because he was talking about the poor in Africa and the poor in this. So he kind of was saying, if your theology is this way, if this is how you want blessed, like, you want to be blessed and financially blessed and prosperity theology, then basically, this is not, he doesn't like poor people.
Well, and I saw that, you know, it's funny that you say that, because in the, so I spent a year in the Philippines, and then I went back later to do my dissertation work. And the community I was doing my dissertation work in was a small rural community. And one of the pastors in that community, again, a very rural, very poor community.
Right.
One of the pastors there, it was a church that had been planted by a Pentecostal movement from the U.S., and it espoused this prosperity gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor there, it's kind of a long story, but, since I was trying to, get to know the leaders of the community and ask their permission
right.
to be there, and he was one of the leaders, I talked to him and he invited me to the church. And
right.
so I went, and the whole sermon was about, you know, you are poor, you are struggling, your children are hungry because you are doing bad things. You
oh,
know,
really?
That was what he was telling his parishioners. He was pointing at one of them and saying, you know, I know that you were smoking a cigarette before I came in because I saw you like throw it on the ground and stomp
right.
it out, you know, and I know that you're doing this and you're doing that. I was absolutely horrified. Like, I couldn't believe that this is what, I mean, I actually started crying. Like,
right.
I was trying to, like, hide it.
Yeah.
You know, I actually started crying because it was just, to me, it was the opposite of
right.
the gospel. You know, I mean, and so I was
wow.
very grateful for
yeah.
the church that I was a part of that taught very firmly, you know, that God is on the side of the poor. Poverty is a violence. Poverty
right.
is an injustice,
yeah.
and we are fighting against it.
Right. Well, you
very
know, as when I went to Southern Sudan for the first time, I bought a Joel Osteen book for my iPod, and it was like 8 Steps to Happiness or something like that. And so I was listening to it in the back of a pickup truck in Southern Sudan. And one of the chapters was talking about how his children, he visualized a house. He didn't own a home. He visualized a house, and he named it and claimed it. And then he was talking in the same chapter that my children are children of God, and it's important that they have the best clothes. Now, tell you, I'm going down a dirt road listening to this, and all these children are running around naked.
Yeah.
And this is where I kind of learned the American evangelical gospel does not connect to anybody else in the world. Because it doesn't work. I just do not see it
working. I would tend to agree with that.
So, now going back to this, let me ask you this. I'm a pastor of this funky little church, okay? And you've been going to the church for a few months, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, even as a pastor, because you said at the beginning of this podcast that you don't see it in the evangelical churches, a love for the poor or ministering to the poor. So, you're sitting in front of a pastor now. So what? How do we do this? Because the poor is not just going to the Philippines or going to another
no.
country.
No.
But the poor represents a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, and I guess what I mean is that we need to be fighting against the forces of injustice and oppression and poverty wherever we find them. And we certainly find them here in Los Angeles,
okay.
of course, as well as overseas. And, you know, I don't have a great, you know, 10-point plan for
right.
ending poverty in Los
right,
Angeles.
Right.
But, you know, Michael, for example, my husband is currently working with the Shelter Partnership Board, which is a coalition to end homelessness in L.A. County. You know, there are groups that are currently working for the rights of undocumented immigrants and to
right.
protect them. And, you know, one of the things that I've found throughout my life is that it's a great idea to find these things that are already going on
mm-hmm.
and where God is already moving and
right.
then to kind of join.
Right.
And I'm still learning about that in L.A.
But let's go by the poor, because in the previous podcast that we didn't air, because I got so excited about this one, you were talking about, as a white person, getting involved in areas of injustice like the Black Lives Movement or the Black Lives Matter. And so, why is that important to you? Obviously, you're in a biracial relationship,
mm-hmm.
but why is that such a connection with you as well when you're seeing this injustice?
Yeah. So I did join a group in Los Angeles here called White People for Black Lives, which is okay. kind of a partner organization to the Black Lives Matter Los Angeles
right.
Chapter. And I've just started, so I'm still learning.
Right.
But I really feel that Black Lives Matter is the most important civil rights movement, or one of them, of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been really impressed with how successful it has been so far
okay.
in raising awareness and concern about
mm-hmm.
the issue of police brutality and racism in society, systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I support it not only because I have a multiracial family, but also because of the other work that I've been doing. Something about LA landscaping.
Sorry about that, guys. I had to stop it because somebody was blowing a blower. What do they call those blowers?
A leaf blower.
A leaf blower,
yeah.
Which is totally against the law. But anyway, we were talking about the Black Lives Matter and white people, and
yeah.
that you have a in your biracial relationship.
I support this movement, you know, not only because I'm personally affected as somebody who's married to a black man and raising a black son, but I also have been working in communities in Detroit and Flint, Michigan, and seen the kind of injustice that's been perpetrated in those communities. And that also has spurred me to action.
Now, do you think because you married a black man and then you're raising essentially a biracial child that looks more black than white, do you think that made you more aware of the injustice?
Yes, absolutely. And I want to be careful here because I don't want to say that automatically if you're married to a black person or in a relationship with a black person that you understand racial
right.
injustice. You know, clearly we see examples where that's not the case.
Right.
But for me, you know, it definitely has hit home to me on a much deeper and more personal level, it being in my personal life compared to, you know, even my black friends talking about it, which
right.
also hits me emotionally too, of course, but like just just witnessing it.
Right.
And I think I told you the example of, you know, Michael and I, my husband, we have conversations about which car he should drive to make it less likely that he'll be pulled over, you
yeah.
know, because we realize that him being pulled over by the police may be a less safe encounter for him than it would be for
right.
me. And, you know, he's a college professor with a PhD and, you know, contributes to the community. But, you know, the fact is that at night driving, people would see him and see a tall, big black man.
Right.
And that, to some people, that is a threat.
Right.
You know, we had an experience a few weeks ago where we were in a parking lot, actually in Malibu, and we accidentally bumped the car. With my arm, I bumped the car next to us and set off the alarm.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were discussing that I should be the one to go find the car owner and talk to them about it because I am less threatening
right.
than my husband, who is a tall black man. You
right.
know, and they would be less likely to call the police and freak out and.
Right.
So these are things that most white people don't think about or have to deal with.
Right.
And the fact is that there is a disproportionate fear of black men in our society. They are viewed as, you know, violent, scary people
mm-hmm.
when that's not the case.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen that one of the outcomes of that is police brutality directed against black men and women
right.
and not being them not being held accountable for it.
Right.
And I think that anybody should find that to be a problem.
Yeah.
You know?
And you don't only talk about it, but you really get involved and you've been on marches before. When it comes to that women's march, you were there, right?
Yeah, and put a plug out for anybody
okay.
who wants to, is maybe thinking about getting involved in White People for Black Lives. There is another march of that group coming up in March, end of March, that I'm planning to be involved in as well, starting in Culver City. So
okay,
yeah.
So because this airs on the 15th, so probably next week.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to be interested in white people getting involved in the Black Lives Matter movement with Laura, Just give me a call or email me, and I can forward
you. Yeah, yeah, hit me up. I'd be happy to put you in touch.
Yeah, and after Laura. Yeah. Now, one thing I've noticed that I think when it comes to our race as white, that we first have to accept that we have privilege. And I think that's, would you think that's the first step to realizing, because a lot of people say, well, if Black people didn't fight, if the Black people didn't run, if the Black people didn't do this, and if this is what white people say to me, and if they were just being compliant to the police officer, then this wouldn't happen. And I think that's probably the most ignorant statement that you can say.
Well, when people say that, I think about my high school, which was a wealthy private school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, mostly white. And I think about the behavior of the kids at that high school. A lot of illegal drugs, not only taking them, but selling them.
Mm-hmm.
People vandalized cars in the parking lot. People drove drunk and under the influence. I mean, I witnessed this personally, and we heard stories about it all the time. People argued with cops. All kinds of bad behavior, which you can say, okay, teenagers do that.
Right.
But because they were wealthy white kids, they got a second chance, right? Yeah. It was like, okay, we'll send them to rehab. Okay, yeah. You know, like slap on the wrist, you know, go
give
back
to
your
parents.
Right, yeah, go, give them to your parents. Give them a stern talking to. If they were black teenagers, that would not have been the reaction.
Right.
It would have been this notion that they are somehow these corrupt criminals, you know, who are just showing their true nature and so have to be dealt with in a severe way. Black people use drugs at the same rate as white people, but nonviolent drug offenders are many times more likely to end up in prison if you're black than if you're white.
Right.
I mean, that, just that in alone does not make sense. It's not fair.
Right.
You know, if you're good, first of all, putting drug offenders in prison does not make sense, period. But if you're going to do it, then, you know, explain those differential rates.
Right, right. Do it all together, all the races.
So that's an example of the privilege you're talking about. Because when you're white, you have the privilege of people looking at you screwing up or making a bad decision and people saying, oh, well, you know, give them another chance. This was a bad decision. It's just a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, they'll... And in fact, I look at those kids from my high school and most of them did straighten their lives around and eventually grew up and got jobs, et cetera.
Right.
But for black teenagers, they don't get that chance.
Right.
And that's not fair.
No, it's not at all. And so going through this experience with the beginning of your experience, accepting Christ, going to college, now you're experiencing a lot of injustice that's happening and, you know, within the black community, but within any community, whether it's undocumented workers and the poor. So you have a consistent passion. I think if you look at your love for the white people getting involved in the Black Lives Matter, and you're looking at the poor and the undocumented workers, there's a common theme that you have, isn't it?
I guess so. Injustice really pisses me off.
I think with you, what I'm seeing and what gets me really excited about is you're using your privilege, your education, to really speak for people that cannot speak for themselves. That society has kind of put them in a category and just said, you don't belong here, you're black, you're poor, you're lower than I. And so I would think that liberation theology, what you're embracing, is almost to the point is we're equal. We are a body. We are the same.
Yeah.
That's what I'm assuming that you have this passion for.
Yeah, I mean, I am an incredibly privileged person. And my year in the Philippines showed that to me. I mean, I have all these resources. I have this tremendous education, this great job, this platform. And that is my consistent prayer, is that God would use me as an instrument of his peace and his righteousness and his justice in the world. And I have screwed up a lot of times. Let me be very clear. I have done this badly. One thing I'm struggling with right now, I continue to struggle with it, is academia itself. You know, academia is extremely white. And there are many problems with the way that women and people of color are treated in academia.
Okay.
And, you know, I am now a tenured professor, and I'm in a position where I feel I have a responsibility to do something about that.
Right.
And so I'm, and, you know, I'm still struggling with what that looks like and what steps that I personally can take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's something I wrestle with. So,
right.
Yeah.
No, okay. Now, let me talk on a more personal side with you, because, you know, with this excitement for your spirituality, again, liberation theology, and I like saying liberation theology because I can pronounce it. It makes me sound intelligent. Liberation theology. It's actually one thing I can actually pronounce. But how did your faith, like, for instance, I want to touch bases. You were adopting a biracial child. That the adoptive parents were going to, the woman
mm-hmm.
picked you guys.
Yeah.
Correct? And said, what did she say?
So Michael and I have been in a process of adoption, proceeding with an adoption for the past 2 years. We started about 2 years ago.
Okay.
And we are planning to adopt from the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
So we've gone through that whole process. We've gotten certified as adoptive parents by the U.S. government and the Dominican government. And we're basically waiting in the queue until they can, you know, match a child with us.
Right.
In the midst of this waiting...
What made you decide to do it in the Dominican Republic?
So we had always, you know, we'd always wanted to expand our family through adoption.
Okay.
And we looked at both domestic and international options. And we... It's kind of a long... thing to talk about, but we did,
okay.
we decided on international for a variety of reasons, and we were really wanting to adopt from Africa, but because of the Hague Convention, which was designed to protect the rights of children, and the kind of increased paperwork and legal burden put on many countries to comply with the Hague Conventions, a lot of African countries have shut down their adoption programs entirely, or the waits are really long. So, for example, Ghana, there's no adoptions going out of Ghana right now. So we ended up deciding on the Caribbean, mainly because we wanted a child that had some African heritage to kind of fit with our family.
Right.
And so our adoption agency in Ann Arbor works with the Dominican Republic, so that was a good program for us.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then so while you were waiting for Dominican, because I got you, I was sidetracked because I was so fascinated with the Dominican Republic, you went with another adoption agency here in the United States.
Well, no, so what happened was our agency that we work with in Michigan processes both domestic and international adoptions. The domestic adoptions they process are primarily most domestic adoptions in the U.S. are either infants, or through foster care.
Okay.
So they have an infant adoption program, and there are a lot of families waiting in that program. So what happens is that a birth mother, you know, when they come to the agency, they would choose which of the waiting couples they would like to raise their child.
Okay.
So this young woman who you're mentioning came in November, and she herself is biracial,
mm-hmm.
and she really wanted a biracial family to raise her child that she was due to have in January. And there were no biracial families in the waiting program for the infants.
Okay.
So our agency called us up and said, you know, would you be willing to meet with this woman, the birth mother, to see if you're the right family for her? And we said, sure.
And this is back in November?
This was in November,
November.
Thanksgiving break.
Okay.
And so we met with her, and we really liked her, and she liked us, I guess. And so we were planning to go forward with the adoption as of the end of November, and the baby was due in January. So it was kind of like all of a sudden, you're going to have a baby in January. I mean, it was crazy.
Right.
It was, you know...
Because I remember you came up to me and your husband and asked me, can we pray for this? Because the baby was due in January.
Yes.
Right, in January. And so you were just praying and hoping things would go, the adoption would go well and stuff like that. And we actually were right there and we prayed outside the church, asked for the Lord's will to be done, and basically prayed I was assuming this adoption was going to be without a hitch.
Right.
So I was looking for it. I even told you guys, I want to dedicate or baptize this child. So then what happened?
So the baby came early. So the Wednesday after Christmas, we were in Atlanta with Michael's family, and we got the call that the birth mother had gone into labor in Michigan.
Okay.
So we immediately got on a plane back to Michigan.
During Christmas.
Right, just after Christmas, like between Christmas and New Year's.
$15,000 airfare.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the least of our concerns at the time.
Yeah, okay.
So we got back to Michigan, and by the time we got there, the baby had been born, but it was extremely difficult birth.
Okay.
And the mother had had some complications that meant that she would not be able to give birth to another child.
Okay.
And our adoption caseworker told us at that point, she's like, look, I gotta tell you guys, in my experience, this may mean that she does not want to go through with the adoption, which is... You can kind of understand that side of it, right?
Right.
If you're told this is the last child you ever will bear,
right,
that changes your perspective on things. So, so we waited, and you know, we waited for. So that was on Wednesday. We waited for Thursday, Friday, and the birth mother still didn't want to see us. And by Friday afternoon, when she was still kind of delaying seeing us, I was thinking, well, this is probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
And in fact, we got the call on Saturday morning that she had decided to parent the child. So,
okay, so she didn't tell you directly.
No, and that's the way it works.
Okay.
I mean, that communication is through the... I like the way that the agency has it set up, that there's a caseworker who is basically the advocate for and communication with the birth mother, and then there's a caseworker that's basically the advocate for the adoptive parents, you know, to make sure that each group has somebody who they feel is acting in their best interest and is representing them.
Yeah,
and
that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that works well.
Okay, so you got so excited... I mean, anticipated from November to January.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, within a few days, it's like, it's not happening.
It was crazy. It was a total emotional roller coaster. I mean, it was, if you think about, from Wednesday thinking that you're going to be a parent that day, and then to Saturday that no, I mean, it was a total emotional roller coaster.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
So, does that affect your faith? How does your faith, God, the whole thing? Is it more questions? Is it more comfort? How does that work for you?
You know, I mean, it was a very hard thing.
Right.
And at times in my life when I've gone through a hard time, my faith has absolutely been a comfort to me.
Okay.
It's because I really, those are the times when I feel that God is there, you know, I feel God's presence. I feel like God's got you,
right.
You know, and God is, it's not that God prevents bad things from happening,
right,
but God is walking with you through them, that God is with you every step of the way. And
right.
I think sometimes in my daily life, I forget that, you know,
right.
I think I'm doing everything myself. I'm fine. I'm a hotshot. I'm great. But it's those times when you really are struggling and really, need that you really feel God's presence. And
right.
And that was one of those times.
Because it's almost interesting that you say, you were talking about God is with the poor, but God is also with the broken.
Absolutely.
When you're broken.
Absolutely.
And it's almost like your theology is consistent with what you just said. This is where you feel the presence of Christ coming alongside of you. In the midst of, I don't have the strength. I don't know how I can deal with this. I went on this huge emotional roller coaster going up and down. And so in a sense, you're saying it's bringing, like, you can be comforted even through your brokenness, even through your tears.
Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, the other thought that I had as I processed this over the subsequent weeks was that, you know, this is not only about me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a baby in all of this who is the most vulnerable person.
Right.
And this was God's plan for the baby, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe this is what God needed to do that was best for that child.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more important than my desire, you know, to have my family come together in this way, you know. So so I fully believe that there is still a child. I mean, there's so many children in this world that don't have a family.
Right.
And there's a child up there for us that's for us.
Oh, absolutely. So. And that it's interesting. And I think when you told me, because I think I asked, hey, how's adoption going? And I looked at your eyes and go, oh, goodness, something just happened.
Yeah, I know. You can tell that
you know,
that was
I was
the
going,
question.
Oh, shoot. Because I was all excited because I was thinking, okay, the date's coming up. But one thing that you said that was really powerful that you said, I understand what the mother's going through. I understand that she made the right decision for her. And it's almost like you chose to go think beyond your pain and understand the pain of that mother, realizing she'll never bear another child, and also that she's realizing I'm holding my child, you know. And yeah. I think a lot of us, we understand that healing is also realizing there's another perspective.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed
with yeah. that. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's still hard. I mean, it's, you know, this adoption process is hard. Period. It was hard. You know, it just the whole, you know, the amount of paperwork and the expense and the emotional investment and the mental investment and the waiting and look, I am not a patient person. That is not one of my virtues. And this is really trying the edges of my patience. You know, but I keep feeling God saying, like, this is the path. Yeah. Just stay on it. Just stay
so
on it.
So you're going to stay on the path? And
we are.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to stay on the path.
Do the adoption. Yeah. So hopefully in less than a year that I get to do that baby dedication or baptism.
Yeah.
Or every belief. It's all about me now.
It's all about me. That's okay. We can make it about you.
It's all about me. I always make it about me. The whole podcast now is about me. So anyway, I wanted to ask this. Your dreams for your son. Because you know what kind of world he's growing up in.
Yeah.
And how old is he?
He's 5.
He's 5 years old. And if you meet her son, he's more... If you have two parents that are professors, the guy's vocabulary is almost like a high schooler, okay? And he has to. It's more than by his choice. You're going to be smart when you have two parents as professors. But what are your dreams for your son, and what are your fears for your son growing up in our society?
I almost don't want to articulate fears because it's like giving, you know, but my dreams are, I mean, I want him to fulfill his potential.
Okay.
I want him to contribute to the world and make the world a better place.
Right.
I want him to be, like every parent, of course, I want him to be happy, and I understand that it's not possible to be happy all the time, but I want him to, on his deathbed in old age, feel that he lived a great life and that he has people who love him and things that he accomplished. And frankly, that's what everybody should have, and that's what every parent should have for their child. And so I guess my hope is that we can work for a world where that is possible, regardless of what race you are, regardless of whether, you know, what religion you are, regardless of where you come from, how much money you have, that's something that every person would have access to.
Right.
So I think we're a ways from that, but...
But, you know, and the thing is, here, I want to close in this question, okay? Let me say it again, liberation theology, okay, that you've embraced... But you live in a country that's mostly evangelical Christians. So you're the minority in the United States, I would assume, when it comes to Christianity. And I wanted you to give a quote that you quote in the last podcast that really is the essence of your walk with God. It's about the reference letter.
Yeah, so this is something that Jim Wallis said. So he's with Sojourner. So he is an evangelical, but he's a very, you know, he's an anti-poverty activist as well.
Okay.
And what he says, I think, which is consistent with liberation theology, is nobody gets into heaven without a reference letter from the poor.
Okay.
So essentially, you know, if you're not, as a Christian, working side by side with the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized, then are you really walking with Jesus?
Right.
I think that's the question he has all of us
asking. And that makes sense, because if you're walking with Jesus, and according to Scripture, because I think you have a lot of Scripture that backs up your belief system, that Jesus is with the poor, Jesus is with the marginalized, this is where he's walking. So in a sense, because that really stuck out to me about a reference letter to the poor, if you really think about that, you can go, oh, shoot, I need a change, if you really believe that.
Exactly. And I don't want to make one further point, too,
that
about justice versus charity. So I think sometimes as Christians, we're very complacent and content with giving charity to the poor and giving things. And there's nothing wrong with giving, you know, giving and being generous is of course a calling of the Christian life. But if that's all we're doing and we're not questioning a system that makes some people poor and others wealthy, then I think we're not fundamentally getting at it. I think we're still, you know, even Martin Luther King Jr. said something like this. He said something like, you know, a charity that flings coins to a beggar but doesn't question, you know, the system that produces beggars,
right,
you know, it needs changing.
Right.
So I see a lot of flinging of coins as the American church. I don't see a lot of questioning
the injustice that makes the poor. Or even the incarcerated.
Or the incarcerated, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
Or the exploited, you know, in our society.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
In fact, we even haven't talked about this, about the women as objectifications in our society.
Yep.
That even in the Christian society, that we have tendencies to look at down at women as weaker than men, and men need to be in control of the whole situation. So that's a whole nother subject.
Yeah, and look at how much you guys mess things up being in control for lots of that.
We love wars.
Yeah, that's one thing we learned about you.
We love wars. Somehow it's our egos. I love your opinions. It's just good. So anyway, so last question. You said in the beginning of this podcast, your husband is helping with something with the homeless?
So, he's on one of the boards for the what's called the Shelter Partnership, which is basically a coalition throughout LA County that's whose goal is to end homelessness. So they do, you know, policy work, they do advocacy, they do fundraising, they do awareness, they do all these kind of things with a goal of ending homelessness.
So is there any way that we can partner with him? Or how,
you know, yeah, you would have to talk to him because he knows more about the details.
Okay.
But absolutely, I would say they're always doing events and campaigns and stuff that people can get involved with. And so I would, I'll encourage him to talk
and
to you.
And this is at the Pepperdine University?
No, this is separate from that.
Okay.
But it's something that's LA countywide. There's a lot of people working on it. Yeah.
That excites me because we were just talking about that this morning about staff, about how we can get involved in helping with the homeless. Then we have someone like your husband that's sitting in the church that just has this boatload of information on how to get involved.
So so people can go, if you're interested, you can also go on Facebook. So you can like them on Facebook, the Shelter Partnership. Just Google that Los Angeles and it'll come up. And so they have a number of campaigns you can get involved in. For example, there's a ballot measure coming up at the end of March that they have an opinion on, Measure S. Learn more information there. So that's the first thing.
Was he the one that authored that? Was he the one?
No. They're actually opposed to it. Opposed to the restrictions on development.
And so the thing is, and to get involved, the white people, if white people want to get involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, the march is, do you have the date? It's the end of March.
It is the last Saturday in March, whatever Saturday
in
that
March.
Is. I can bring more information to the church and share it with you.
Okay, so we'll have that in the back of the sanctuary before the 15th. So, so when you hear this on the Wednesday, on the 15th, the following Sunday, we'll have all the information on that if you want to get involved. Or if you just want to talk to Laura and say, look, tell me more about your liberation theology. Tell me more why you don't like evangelicals.
I didn't say that.
I'm just kidding. I'm just joking.
You're trying to get me in trouble.
I know. But see, the thing is, I'm so much like you. This is what gets me so excited about it. Because I have difficulties with the evangelical movement. But I think, this is my opinion, that I think because where we're going as a country, this is the greatest opportunity for the church to actually be the church and to really reach out to the marginalized. And I remember, for me, I just signed up this church as a sanctuary. Mm. And we put all the address. I didn't ask anyone's permission. I just got all excited and signed up. I don't know if I should have done that without permission, but we're a sanctuary church. So anyway, thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
And I appreciate it. Thank you for listening to this podcast. And if you thought, hey, man, I need Laura, I need I need to refer this to a friend. You just send the link and say, hey, encourage her. If you want to talk to Laura, she's at her 10 o'clock service. We're down to one service for during Lent, and we're right in the middle of Lent. So introduce yourself to Laura and ask her about her podcast and ask her any questions and how to get involved. And remember, every day is a gift from God, and use it wisely. And join us next week for another podcast. God bless. That was a good one.